This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Julian Warwicker. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 28th of January. We report from the Democratic Republic of Congo as Rwandan-backed M23 rebels consolidate their control of the city of Goma in the east. Some reports say as many as 100 people have died with no sign of a let-up in the fighting. Rachel Reeves is due to deliver a major speech on growth. What might she reveal about the government's plans for a third runway at Heathrow Airport? And we hear from a man whose Parkinson's symptoms have improved significantly thanks to a new treatment being offered to patients in Newcastle. We begin tonight in mineral-rich East Africa, where a conflict that's been brewing for decades has spiralled into a full-blown crisis in recent days. Bodies are lying in the streets of the city of Goma in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's according to the United Nations. And hundreds of people have been wounded. An advance by rebels known as the M23, who the UN and other experts say are backed by neighbouring Rwanda, has led to ferocious fighting in and around the city.
I've heard where I am, quite close to the city centre, sporadic bursts of gunfire today.
It is tense, even right now. We saw the rebels walking on our way here, on our main road here, towards the town.
The rebels claim they've seized the airport in Goma, a situation confirmed by diplomatic and security sources, and at least 17 foreign peacekeepers have been killed. One news agency is estimating that as many as 100 people may have died. In the DRC capital, Kinshasa, people have demonstrated their anger at the international community for failing to do more to stop the fighting. Foreign embassies have been targeted by crowds, and police fired tear gas at protesters. Well, this evening, the US Embassy in DRC advised American citizens in the country to shelter where they were and then safely depart while commercial options are available. Well, the UN Security Council is meeting right now to discuss the conflict. In the past hour, the UN's special representative in Goma, Vivian van der Peer, briefed them on the situation there.
The degree of suffering that the population in Goma and its environments is enduring is truly unimaginable. Let us please draw on our humanity and do our utmost to bring an immediate end to such levels of violence and suffering.
Well, Shelley Thakral is the World Food Programme spokesperson for the DRC and joins me live from the capital, Kinshasa. I know you're in touch, Shelley, with staff in Goma. What are you hearing from there just now?
Thanks, Julian. Let's just remember that overnight, people were waking up this morning to their sort of second night, first full night of the M23 having walked into Goma yesterday, having surrounded and having kind of encroached on the provincial capital. They woke up to heavy shelling, artillery. I spoke to one civil society activist who we work with, and he just said, "I'm in hiding. I don't know if I have enough food. I don't know if I have enough water. I just don't know what to do. I'm trapped. I'm suffocated." So obviously, from the World Food Programme's point of view, our biggest concern has been that when you cut off the land and the water and the air from a big region like Goma and its surrounding area, you just worry that time is running out for people to get the food that they need, to have access to clean water, to medical supplies.
Because this was a city that was already in a great deal of need prior to this fighting, wasn't it?
This is right. I mean, only 20 kilometres away, which is really nothing. People have been living in these overcrowded makeshift camps. People have been displaced, not once, not twice, but multiple times from the conflict that's been going on for decades. Let's just remember, this is decades. This is a protracted crisis. Yes, it's escalated in the last 72 hours, in the last 24 hours. We probably won't have an immediate solution because it's just been this kind of stretch of conflict for so many years, for a generation almost, who've never known anything different but to not have their land, to not live in their homes. But yes, you know, the capital has been surrounded by these displaced people who have been living in really dire, catastrophic means. I mean, it's the situation is really grim.
And a brief word on Kinshasa, where you are, protests we've heard about. What sense do you get of those just now?
I think they'll continue, Julian. I think we're not going to see the last of what seems to be this sort of tinderbox. You know, today, you know, I tried to get into the office. I was turned away. Just people on the street, on motorbikes. I heard in your clips, you know, embassies being set alight. I've seen, you know, from my own balcony, just people just throwing and burning tires in the road. I think this is going to take some time to settle. I think, you know, from the World Food Programme's point of view, and I'm sure other UN agencies, and as you mentioned, the Security Council, we need a cessation in violence. We need to be able to get on with our jobs and get to the people who need our help the most.
Thank you very much, Shelley Thakral in Kinshasa. Well, the roots of the conflict in eastern DRC can be traced back decades. I asked the BBC's Africa correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, to remind us what it's all about.
If you do look back decades, actually what you see is the long shadow of the Rwanda genocide, because the conflict in eastern Congo for the past 30 years has been linked to that. When Hutu extremists murdered nearly 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus, then some of them who carried out the genocide fled into Congo. That triggered two regional wars, including invasions by Rwanda in the late 90s. And the region's been unstable since for this and other reasons, but this is a big factor. Now we fast forward to the M23, it's a Congolese militia largely made up of the minority ethnic Tutsi group, and says that it is trying to protect Tutsi rights. And so therefore it has the sympathy of the Rwandan government, which is largely Tutsi, but it also has the backing of that government, according to many players, although that is something that Kigali denies. I should add here that the Rwandans are concerned about the Hutu militias that still are in Congo, that are fighting together with the Congo army. So they see that as a security threat. And although they have not admitted, in fact denied, that they are providing material and military support to the M23, that is a security concern that they have.
Why have things got so much worse in recent days?
Well, they got worse actually in the past couple of years to begin with. So the M23 has had upsurges of violence. And then about 3 years ago, they resurfaced and they went on the warpath again in eastern Congo, which is essentially their base. It's right next to Rwanda. And they made massive inroads in eastern Congo until a few days ago, when they went sort of with lightning speed on Goma. Now, you could ask why that is. The Congolese government says it's because they are getting weapons and support actually from Rwandan forces in Congo. The UN has also said that Rwandan soldiers are active. Why did they do it now? It seems to have been perhaps a political decision that this was the right time. It's possible, I'm speculating a bit here, but in December, peace talks between Rwanda and Congo broke down, and that was because Congo refused to negotiate directly with M23. That's something that Rwanda insisted on. So some analysts think, well, maybe this was an outcome of that, and that will be one of the cards to play if you get to the point of actually talking about a ceasefire.
So there's complex politics at play, clearly. Mineral wealth is part of this story as well, isn't it?
It very much is. I mean, mineral wealth is part of the story of conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, even more widely. It's not just M23, but other groups, too, who are fighting, basically, over that wealth. But it is a factor in this conflict in particular, because M23 has gained control over the past 3 years of the routes that supply Goma and of mining towns. So for a year, they've been in control of a region that mines coltan. This is important for smartphones and other equipment. And they've been able to get money, revenue, by levying a production tax on this coltan. The UN report that came out, I think about a year ago or so, also says that M23 is actually shipping minerals to Rwanda, which then exports them. And so the Congolese accuse Rwanda, saying that their main goal is to try to get access to these minerals. Now, again, Kigali dismisses any notion that anything underhanded is going on, but certainly minerals are very much at the heart of the turmoil in eastern DRC.
The focus at the moment, of course, is on the fighting, on the humanitarian consequences of that fighting. At some point, presumably, a political solution will begin to emerge here. Where might that come from? What might be the driving forces of that, do you think?
You know, it's difficult to say. So it looked as if they were making progress in December. There were various steps taken by both sides, and then it broke down, as I said. The other element is international pressure, Western countries being quite vocal about it. So we'll see if that moves any further.
Our Africa correspondent Barbara Plaid-Usher, well, talking of international pressure, this afternoon in the House of Commons, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy echoed the UN in saying that the Rwandan Defence Forces were aiding the M23 rebels. The Rwandan government has denied this. The last Conservative government had pursued a new, deeper partnership with Rwanda, including striking a deal to send some asylum seekers there. The Conservative MP Andrew Mitchell is a former Africa Minister and International Development Secretary. I asked him what he thought of the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' call for the Rwandans to stop their support for the rebels and to withdraw from their neighbours' territory.
Well, I think it's an exceedingly complex situation. The Rwandans have actually never made any secret that they are involved in the borderlands because they need to defend their border. It's a very porous border, and there's been fighting and firing across it. The right answer to this, which I think Antonio Guterres is also making, is that both Rwanda and the DRC should go back to the peace process. They should negotiate, lay down their guns, and go back to that peace process.
We're now, though, in a very different place, are we not? We've got the M23 rebels advancing successfully on this key city, capturing the airport possibly, although reports on that are uncertain. Reports of hundreds wounded, bodies lying in the streets. If the Foreign Secretary is right when he says this is simply a country attacking its neighbour, don't we have to look differently at this now?
The answer to all these things is to negotiate. And I think that President Tshisekedi of the DRC has been very unwilling for the M23 to negotiate directly with the government in Kinshasa and with the Congolese army. That is one of many reasons why the situation in Goma is so desperate. And it will not get better until the president of the DRC recognizes his responsibility to engage and negotiate with all parties as well as with Rwanda.
You place an emphasis there on what you say the DRC should do, but what should Rwanda do?
Well, in my view, both sides should pull back and both sides should do everything they can to ensure that those that over whom they have some control, that they lay down their weapons. That's the most important thing because, as you rightly point out, enormous numbers of people are in great jeopardy there. Civilians are in great humanitarian need. And while the fighting goes on, nothing will be able to be done to help them.
Can I just look specifically at what David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, has said today, that £32 million worth of UK aid to Rwanda is, quote, under threat because it's attacking a neighbour. Do you support that threat? Should that £32 million of UK aid now be in question, in your view?
Well, I don't think it should be in question. That aid to which you refer is helping educate girls in schools. It's helping make sure that agriculture is boosted, and it's helping make sure that healthcare is boosted as well. So I wouldn't go down that route myself. The correct route to go down is to seek to persuade all sides to negotiate. The government of the DRC has failed to exercise the basic sinews of government that should be exercised in the eastern part of their country. Rwanda is bound to react to lawlessness on their border. The most important thing is that people should lay down their weapons and negotiate.
Can I look back, though, to when you were in a position to make decisions in this area? Because as far back as 2012, aid to Rwanda, half of it, was suspended over concerns about the country's alleged behaviour in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it then changed its behaviour. So if it worked then, why not do it again now?
Well, it is true that I suspended British aid for a period of time because of events that were taking place.
The situation, and it made a difference.
Well, the situation is not the same today, and that is why I say that the critical efforts of the British government, the United Nations and others should be to recognise that there have been colossal failures of governance in the DRC, and that the important thing now is for everyone to lean on all these different parties.
I mean, you've been accused in the past of having a personal interest in maintaining good relations with Rwanda and indeed the country's leader, Paul Kagame, because of the work that you did on various projects prior to becoming International Development Secretary. Is that still in your mind in what you're thinking now?
Well, all that those projects meant was that I hope I have a real understanding of what is happening in the region and a real understanding of the events that have taken place in Rwanda since the genocide, which, I remind you, killed nearly a million people. I understand what's going on in the region, and I am very sympathetic with Rwanda for this reason, that we have seen the Congolese army and the FDLR, which is the genocidal force that killed all those people in Rwanda. We have seen them today working together. The relationship between the Congolese army and the FDLR is far too close, and it should be disavowed by the president and the government of the DRC.
What are the concerns about the region and what it's rich in, namely mineral wealth? The DRC government has said that because of that, this is as much about the economic plunder of our country, they say, by Rwanda, as it is about anything else that we've been discussing.
Well, that is why it's so important that we get to a position where there is peace in the eastern DRC, so that the government of the DRC can develop those minerals for the benefit of the people they are supposed to serve. And if there was peace and order, that is exactly what I think would happen.
Conservative MP Andrew Mitchell. Now, when Rachel Reeves stands up in Oxfordshire tomorrow to give what's being billed as a major speech, it's fair to say growth will be at the heart of it. Labour says it's been its principal mission since it won power last summer, although so far it's proved rather elusive when it comes to delivery. Her critics say her budget didn't help. Over the weekend, the government did announce plans to fast-track permission for housing and commercial developments near train stations and changes to planning rules running alongside the rolling back of environmental impact assessments. There have also been hints that the government will back a third runway at Heathrow Airport. Well, Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt is here. So what's she likely to say tomorrow, Nick?
Well, clearly the Prime Minister and Rachel Reeves have sort of entered the new year thinking maybe the first 6 months of this government were not as fast or as successful as they could have been, and they really absolutely have to go for it on growth. This has not been confirmed and is not being confirmed overnight, but there is a very, very strong expectation that we will see tomorrow the green light for some pretty serious airport expansion. Yes to the emergency runway at Gatwick being used for normal flights. Yes to more terminals at Luton. That is building up the existing infrastructure. The big one is it looks like a green light for a third runway at Heathrow, which would be massively expanding the estate there. That's why that's different. But that's not start building tomorrow. That's the government saying to Heathrow, if you want to do it, yes, and then a very lengthy process would start.
How much is resting on this politically for her, do you think?
I think an enormous amount is resting on this politically for the Chancellor and for the Prime Minister. I mean, if you were only allowed to sum up Keir Starmer in one word, you'd say growth. What did he say in the general election? We will deliver growth. We will liberalise planning laws. We will do what the Tories didn't. We will deliver sustainable growth. They've had anemic growth, you could say, world factors in the first 6 months of this government. They know that they've got to deliver growth. But the key thing in and the lesson from Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who had really good growth, is you can have great growth. But if you can't explain that to how that makes people feel better, feel wealthier, feel they're on the right side of cost of living, then you won't get an electoral dividend.
Nick, thank you very much. Nick Watt, Newsnight's political editor. Coming up on The World Tonight, how a computer-controlled brain implant fit into a man with Parkinson's disease has worked so well, he feels cured from the condition.
Now I've got the confidence to go out and meet people again, so I can go to the pub, I like a game of snooker, and now I can play snooker again.
Now, when MPs voted in favour of the assisted dying bill for England and Wales last November, its backers stressed how much further scrutiny it would then undergo before it could become law. Well, that process got underway today as the committee charged with carrying out that detailed work began hearing 3 days of evidence. The bill could see terminally ill adults with under 6 months to live legally allowed to end their lives, subject to approval by two doctors and a High Court judge. Well, England's Chief Medical Officer, Professor Sir Chris Whitty, was first to appear, one of about 50 witnesses due to be heard this week. He told the committee that that six-month time frame was appropriate, but he cautioned that if the bill does become law, it mustn't be made too complicated.
The central person here is an average citizen in their last 6 months of life. What we don't want is a system that is very difficult for them to navigate, so they spend their entire last 6 months of life, if this bill is passed and they choose to take account of it, which is going to be a minority, essentially stuck in a bureaucratic thicket. We do need to keep this simple. And my view is the best safeguards are simple safeguards, so overcomplicating actually usually makes the safeguard less certain, to be honest.
Well, joining me live is the Liberal Democrat MP Sarah Olney, who sits on the committee. She voted against assisted dying in November and has tabled an amendment to tighten the language in the bill around mental capacity. Sarah Olney, good evening.
Good evening.
Why that focus for you on mental capacity and the wording of the bill in that area?
It's because the bill at the moment categorises the capacity of an individual to make a decision to opt for assisted dying with reference to something called the Mental Capacity Act 2005. And I suppose what I'm doing is I'm posing the question is the assessment of mental capacity that is regularly used throughout medical decision making today, and actually that was extensively discussed by Professor Sir Chris Whitty this morning in the evidence session, but is that sufficient for this kind of decision making? And one of my concerns is that the Mental Capacity Act has a number of different features. One of the things it does is it assumes its baseline assumption is that people will have the capacity, and you will only judge someone as not having capacity if there is evidence. If there's evidence that their brain is impaired or that their decision making is in any way impacted, and that as long as they can meet sort of certain tests of decision making, then they will be assumed to have capacity. So in a sense, I'm just asking the question: is that the right approach for this particular decision? Because of course, it's very, very different from a decision about the right kind of drugs to be taking or a treatment pathway or whatever.
And what do you say the potential consequences of not clarifying that are in your mind?
So I think one of my anxieties about the bill as it stands is that because we are just sort of defining capacity with reference to the Mental Capacity Act, there's no specific requirement to undertake a psychological assessment of the person who is considering opting for assisted dying. And what I worry about is that you can have capacity to make decisions, but that your decision will nevertheless be influenced by potentially an underlying mental health condition. We know that depressive illnesses are quite common in people who are suffering from a terminal illness.
And you talked to people with eating disorders in this context, haven't you?
So this is my particular concern, because of course eating disorders, it's a mental health condition, but of course it has very devastating physical impacts. And you could easily find yourself in a situation where you'll be assessing someone's capacity to make a decision. You're not doing the psychological assessment, so you're not necessarily picking up the eating disorder, but the eating disorder has a physical element. Of course it does. And that could well then become the terminal illness. So it just feels like, personally for me, I think we need a different measure of capacity. And that's why I'm proposing that we replace the language around capacity with ability, because it's a different measure.
Just on that specific area, and the bill says anyone who wants to end their life must have, and to use your phrase, the mental capacity to make the choice, but also to be deemed to have expressed a clear, settled and informed wish, free from coercion or pressure. If you add those other elements to that sentence, does that not put your mind to rest to an extent?
I think one of the things that, this whole issue about mental capacity, I have to be honest with you, I only started looking at it since I became a member of this bill committee. So I'm certainly not an expert. But one of the things that has come through quite strongly in the written evidence that's been submitted so far is that capacity can fluctuate. So somebody can demonstrate capacity today, but not tomorrow, if you see what I mean. Mm. So that for me is, how can you have a settled wish if your capacity to express that wish fluctuates? So that is potentially a bit of a conflict.
As I explained at the start of this conversation, this is the start of the scrutiny process, and you're on the committee that is doing the scrutinising. And I said that you voted against in November. Is your view fixed on this, or is there something you could hear in the coming weeks that might change your mind, do you think?
I'm not sure that my view is fixed, but certainly my reason for voting no in November is very much it's a principled. I'm just not comfortable with the idea that we have legislation that legitimates the taking of another person's life. But you know, I am really keen to get into the details of what's being proposed, and certainly we've heard so much from people who want to talk about suffering at the end of life and how that can be eased. And nobody who, you know, can listen to those stories and not be motivated by compassion. So I'm motivated by principle on this, but I understand a point the other way. And I really want to understand if there's a way that we can put sufficient safeguards around enabling that decision.
Sarah Olley, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. A few days ago, very few people had heard of the Chinese artificial intelligence app DeepSeek. Then came yesterday's dramatic fall in the value of the leading US chip firm for AI, NVIDIA, and people wanted explanations. That was when it emerged that DeepSeek was reportedly developed for a fraction of the cost of its rivals, raising questions about the future of America's AI dominance. Well, DeepSeek has already overtaken some of those rivals, including ChatGPT, to become the most downloaded free app in the United States. And President Trump said it was a wake-up call for America's technology industry. So how does it compare when it comes to the information it provides? We asked three generative AI sites about the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests in Beijing. Now, this is part of a long and comprehensive response by OpenAI's ChatGPT.
On the 4th of June 1989, the Chinese government launched a brutal military crackdown on pro-democracy protesters who had been occupying Tiananmen Square in Beijing for weeks.
While Google's Gemini was somewhat more succinct.
On the 4th of June 1989, the Chinese government violently suppressed a pro-democracy protest in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, China.
This is how DeepSeek responded to the query.
Sorry, that's beyond my current scope. Let's talk about something else.
Well, Kieran Martin ran the National Cybersecurity Centre at GCHQ and is now at the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. Kieran Martin, good evening.
Good evening.
Three answers, two factual, one very evasive. What does that tell you about DeepSeek compared with its rivals?
It tells you about the way it conforms to Chinese law. A couple of years ago, the Cyberspace Administration of China, which is the public authority which regulates online activity and the actions of Chinese tech companies, published something called the Interim Measures for the Management of Generative AI Services. And it requires Chinese AI large language model developers, DeepSeek being the one we're all talking about now, to conform to socialist values, not to do anything that will undermine state power or national unity. And because these things can be, well, a key part of developing a large language model is what they call fine-tuning, where you essentially teach it to teach itself about what it can and can't say and how not to say it. So, for example, the Western models, the American models, have been trained not to suggest harmful activity after some early scares that you may remember. So DeepSeek has been trained and programmed not to answer controversial questions about Chinese past and present policies.
So the levels of influence of all of these, wherever they come from, are significant, potentially from their respective controlling governments.
They can be. China is the only real sort of superpower alternative to the US for AI. Most of the, if you like, codes of practice and finessing for safety reasons of ChatGPT, Gemini, and the other American models have been done essentially voluntarily. The European Union has put in place legislation, for example, on data security and data assurance. So it requires large language models to what they say to the greatest extent possible to be free of bias. But that's not enforced yet, and it's going to be phenomenally difficult to achieve. So we're in the early days, and what we've seen with DeepSeek is really the first example of major state control of some of the outputs. And it's very obvious. I mean, we, in other areas of tech, we debate TikTok's algorithm and so forth, which is something that really is poorly understood. This is really obvious how it's working.
The Australians have spoken out on this subject. Their science minister, the first member of a Western government to raise privacy concerns about DeepSeek. Is he right to have those concerns, do you think?
Yes, and I think he's probably the first cabinet minister of a major Western country to say the quiet part out loud. But here in the UK, I mean, Peter Kyle, the technology secretary, has said that this is a Chinese app that obviously and very very flagrantly practices censorship. So in his words, make your own decisions. I think in terms of what the Australians have said, which I think reflects widespread expert fears. So here in the UK, we've had Dame Wendy Hall and Mike Wooldridge, two of the UK's leading AI experts, say, look, this is data that's going to China. And DeepSeek's terms and conditions, the data it gathers, seem to be fairly extensive. So it will be gathering lots of data about its users in the West. And one can assume, given custom and practice in China, that that not just could, but probably would be going to the Chinese authorities. So that security and privacy risk comes in. And that doesn't really arise to the same extent with the Western models.
Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. Now, something more uplifting to end our conversations. It's a high-tech treatment for Parkinson's disease, which is being offered to patients at Newcastle's Royal Victoria Infirmary. It involves an implant to the brain, which is controlled by a tiny computer in the chest. That computer sends electrical messages which help manage patients' symptoms and improve their quality of life. Surgeons hope an adapted version of the deep brain simulation system will have a huge impact on people living with Parkinson's. The number with the disease stands at around 153,000 in the UK. Well, earlier I spoke to Akbar Hussain, a neurosurgeon at Newcastle Hospitals, one of the first doctors in the world to offer the new treatment, and to one of his patients, Kevin Hill. Kevin told me first how his Parkinson's was prior to him having the implant fitted.
Basically, it was playing havoc with my life. Parkinson's affects different people in different ways, and with me it was the tremor, and it was getting worse by the week. And I was finding that I wasn't going out and socialising. I was hiding myself. I was getting withdrawn. It was affecting my mental health.
Because you'd been diagnosed, what, 5 years prior to that, I think, hadn't you?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
You'd got that gradual deterioration in your overall state of health over that.
Yeah, period. And I would say things just getting worse and worse as it progressed.
So when this option of the implant was put in front of you, what did you think?
I was in two minds whether to go for it or not, because it seemed to be a big operation for to go through, and it wasn't a promise of success.
And when it was turned on, what happened?
I've been shaking for years, and my wife was there, and they went on a computer, and it was just instant. I was told beforehand that sometimes it takes a year, possibly longer, for them to calibrate it to get it right. But with me, it was instant, absolutely amazing. I was in disbelief, so I just all just stopped the shaking.
And it's continued like that ever since, has it?
I've had me good days and bad days, but I have more good days than I do bad days.
Akbar, tell us a bit about this device, how it's fitted, how it works.
So it's in two parts, really. The main part is the battery itself, which contains the computer chip as well. And that's a little thing that's, it's developed from like cardiac pacemaker technology. But instead of hooking it up to wires that go to the heart, I hook it up to wires that I've implanted into the middle of the brain. So these two wires target the deep brain structures, sit underneath the skin, and then plug into the battery, which sits on this chest wall. And because it's in the right place, so one of the most essential parts is getting the wires into the right place. Once it's in the right place, you can then send little pulses of energy to these deep brain structures. And the wiring or the electrical activity that is not quite working well in these different disease processes, such as Parkinson's disease or dystonia or essential tremor, we can fine-tune the stimulus in order to disrupt what we call pathological electrical activity, so we can get rid of some of their symptoms that the patient's suffering from.
I mean, Kevin talked about the instant change he felt. Is that what you would anticipate?
That is different for different people, and we do warn people that it's effective and helps about 80% of people who have the deep brain stimulation device. But there is a group of people that it might not help as well as has helped Kevin. So it does take a little bit of counselling, making sure the patients are on board. And sometimes it does take maybe 3, 4, 5 visits before we get to as good as we have got with Kevin straight away. We'll do our best to make sure we do improve a patient's quality of life enough so that they do deem it worthwhile.
Kevin, on that quality of life point, what are you able to do now that you couldn't do before?
No, I've got the confidence to go out and meet people again so I can go to the pub. I don't mind going out. I used to like to go out and ride on my bike. That's one thing I couldn't do because I was in the aches and pains. I like a game of snooker and now I can play snooker again.
Akbar, how widely could this be used and applied to patients, well, across the country? I mean, figures in front of me here, about 150,000 people in this country are living with Parkinson's at the moment. How many of those could this potentially help?
It's known as advanced Parkinson's therapy. So even if we're just related to the conventional deep brain stimulation, which, and not the new adaptive stimulation, which we've launched recently, just the conventional deep brain stimulation could be used in a wider group of patients. And I think there is a lack of penetrance of the amount of people that are eligible or would do well with deep brain stimulation with Parkinson's disease or dystonia that aren't being referred through appropriately and aren't getting to us that could really benefit from this kind of therapy.
What of the potential risks, downsides that might be present here? I mean, this is complicated. It's invasive surgery. There must be risks.
There's no such thing as brain surgery without any risks, unfortunately. But out of all the different types of brain surgery that we do, this is probably the safest one we do because it's very minimally intrusive. We make very small cranial drill holes, which to allow the passage of these 2 millimeter width wires to go down through the brain into the target area. And the risks that we're talking about are less than 1%.
And once it's making a difference, I mean, once somebody is significantly better as a result of having this fitted, as Kevin clearly is, I mean, is there any reason why that situation cannot continue? I mean, can you put a timescale on for how long something like this can be realistically effective?
The deep brain stimulation doesn't modify the disease process. You still have Parkinson's disease. And just as with anybody else, the symptoms will progress over time. Now, how long it takes to progress is individual. It's different for different people. I don't think that we'll have to worry about the longevity being just a couple of years. I think it is, we're talking about decades.
Right.
But it is an individual thing.
I mean, that's food for thought, Kevin, isn't it, in terms of how long this could make a difference for you?
Yeah, it's excellent news to think we'll get 20 years out of this. Is amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Kevin Hill, and you heard Akbar Hussain as well, neurosurgeon at Newcastle Hospitals. Before we go, a quick look at some of tomorrow's front pages, many of them looking ahead to the Chancellor Rachel Reeves' speech on growth tomorrow that we talked about earlier. The Guardian's front page headline is Reeves pledges to create Europe's Silicon Valley in push for growth. The paper says the Chancellor will reveal a, quote, blueprint to boost growth, specifically between Oxford and Cambridge. And The Telegraph leads with a quote from the Chancellor saying that she will fight for growth. It says Ms. Reeves will confront cabinet opposition to the expansion of Heathrow, Gatwick and Luton Airport. Certainly expecting some clarification on all of those tomorrow. That is The World Tonight. This is Julian Warwicker. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry with the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.